Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we'll talk about homelessness in the Valley with Clint Olivier and learn about his six-point plan to stop people he calls vagrants. Would it criminalize homelessness, or is it a much overdue step to keep our streets safe? We'll also talk to the man behind the new National Geographic documentary about the antique store find of the century that just happened to be found in Fresno's Tower District, a photo that some claim could be worth $5 million of the famed Billy the Kid. Right now, though, we turn our attention to the drought. By 2040, California will be hotter, drier, and have a lot more people. Our NPR partner station KPCC in Pasadena produced a series of reports imagining the future of water in the Golden State. This morning we go to the farm. Half of all fruits, vegetables, and nuts grown in the United States come from California. To do that, farmers here use 80% of the water used by cities, farms, and industry. The other half of California's water supply system is largely used by the environment. Will those ratios still be the case in 25 years from now? In a special series called The Future of Water from KPCC in Pasadena, Ben Bergman reports.
Believe it or not, the answer to that question is probably yes. To find out how that could be in a world of more frequent drought, I traveled to Madera County to meet almond farmer Tom Rogers. In many ways, his 175-acre orchard, smack in the center of the San Joaquin Valley, is the farm of the future. A future where, like it or not, almonds are almost certain to be the state's number one crop. As I pull up, a giant mower-like machine rakes the nuts that have fallen to the ground into neat rows.
These were some of the first almonds planted in this area, and it's been a good crop for us.
In the 70s, Roger's father made a prescient decision. He ditched the cotton, corn, and alfalfa his father grew and planted almonds. Thanks to strong demand from Asia, they've become a very lucrative crop. The downside is the trees require constant watering.
It's a scary time. I mean, we're very concerned about what's going on.
So this year, Rogers made his own possibly prescient decision. He not only installed drip irrigation, but he put in a system that's as much digital gadgets as it is pipes and tubes. In the middle of a row of almond trees, Rogers pulls a soil moisture probe out of the ground.
Up on top is a rain gauge and a wind speed indicator. The panel up there measures the amount of sunlight.
This is one of the data stations in the orchard where sensors record measurements about the exact conditions on Rogers Ranch. Temperature, humidity, the amount of moisture. All the information gets uploaded to the internet every 15 minutes, which allows Rogers to make decisions about exactly how much water the trees need.
Usually I spend maybe an hour or so each evening looking at it. I can read it on the smartphone. I prefer it on the computer. I guess I'm getting older. I want a bigger screen.
Instead of getting soaked once a week with sprinklers, his nearly 15,000 trees get tiny doses of water every day.
In essence, they're spoon-feeding the tree.
Heather Cooley is with the Pacific Institute, which tracks the California egg industry and its water use. For a long time, drip irrigation was seen by most farmers as just a niche method for high-yield crops because it can cost $1 million to install. But now Cooley says the drought has changed the equation.
They're shifting because it allows them to use water more efficiently. So we're starting to see drip irrigation on even some of these lower value crops.
But there's a paradox to all this efficiency. The more water Rogers and other farmers save with drip irrigation, the more incentive they have to use that saved water to plant more crops, particularly water-intensive crops like almonds. Larry Yee is president of the Food Commons, a group working to reform how food is grown and distributed.
Irrigation technology that we're using today is much more efficient than it was 20 years ago. But then if we plant crops that take a lot more water, then overall we could have a greater water demand than what we have now.
So while farms of the future will probably be more efficient with water, they won't necessarily be using less of it. Another thing about the farm of the future, there will be many fewer of them, says Jay Lund, who studies agriculture at UC Davis.
We could easily see a 5 to 20% reduction in irrigated area.
By 2040, that could be as much as 2 million acres taken out of production, an area roughly half the size of L.A. County. Most of that will be lost to subdivisions and shopping malls for California's growing population. But a lot will be permanently retired because of a lack of reliable water, which is already devastating farms in the Tulare Basin.
They're basically dependent upon imported water, and if that water is not available, some of those towns are going to have to find some other source of economic activity.
But even though there will be fewer farms, the egg industry will likely continue reaping record revenues well into the future because of the continued shift towards more valuable crops like wine grapes, nuts, and tree fruit. When Lund and his team of UC Davis researchers used computer modeling to see what would happen if there was a 72-year mega drought, they were surprised how minor the overall impacts would be.
One of the things I think that study points out is California, particularly with its very large infrastructure system that can move water around pretty well relative to other states, can accommodate some pretty big water shocks, even permanent water shocks.
About 50 miles west from Tom Rogers' Farm of the Future is Philip Bull's 11,000-acre spread of cotton, tomatoes, and alfalfa.
Oh, here's a pretty mangy-looking alfalfa field.
Bull's gives me a tour in his truck. Despite alfalfa's rep as a low-value commodity that needs more water than any other crop, Bull says he still plans to grow it, even though he didn't plant any this year because of the drought. Part of his farm looks more corporate than barnyard, like the cavernous boardroom where we sat down later.
If we were to stop growing alfalfa in California, it means we wouldn't have a dairy industry anymore. It's not just an alfalfa industry.
Bowles represents the fifth generation of his family to work this land.
Water's a big expense for us. We don't want to use any more than we have to.
Bowles doesn't expect his farm to operate much differently in the next 25 years than it has in the past 159. And he doesn't think other California farms will change much either. Bottom line, he thinks people are making much too big a deal out of the drought.
The system that we have can be adapted. It doesn't have to be blown up. It doesn't have to be abandoned. There's still, a lot of water in this state, and people overlook that.
That's not to say farms of the future won't face big challenges. More frequent droughts will likely mean less reliable water supplies, and under new rules, California farms won't be able to continue drawing unchecked amounts of groundwater. That said, California's status as the produce isle of America will probably stay firmly rooted for decades to come. I'm Ben Berkman.
This is Valley Edition. Clint Olivier is fed up. The Fresno City Council member and candidate for the 31st Assembly District says vagrants have overrun Fresno neighborhoods for too long. Last week, he announced his six-point plan to take on the issue with an op-ed in the Fresno Bee, and it's generated a lot of discussion and some controversy. Some say it's about time that city officials took a more aggressive stance on the issue, but others say he's following exactly the wrong approach, saying it would criminalize those who are most in need of help and compassion from society. Clint, welcome to our program. Thanks for bringing your 6 points to our air.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
You open up your column with a very provocative statement, and I quote here, "We are facing the greatest crisis since the specter of bankruptcy loomed over City Hall 5 years ago. The damage done to our city by the homeless is out of control. They have overrun nearly every park, along with hundreds of street corners and shopping centers." You're painting this almost as an existential threat. Why are you so concerned about this issue in particular?
Well, it is an existential threat to many, many people, including our small business owners. It's occurring everywhere, but especially in the core neighborhoods, the more established neighborhoods. And of course, I represent these neighborhoods. Just a week ago, my colleague from the northeast part of town, the Lee Brand, of course, that's a newer and more affluent part of town. He held a community meeting to talk about homelessness, and I mean, he attracted 250, 300 people. He had Chief Dyer, he had the city manager, and the folks at his meeting, which I attended, were angry. And the people in my part of town are quite angry about the problems caused by, and I guess we'll get into homeless versus vagrant. The one thing that I've been able to find, I've been in office for 5 years now, almost 5 years, and the one thing that I've been able to glean from the whole process is that disdain for the problems left behind by vagrants is universal. I represent some economically very challenged neighborhoods where people are living in areas of high concentrated poverty. I also represent the old Fig Garden part of Fresno, which is the city part anyway, where we have people who make $1 million a year living there. So what I have found is that everyone is united in that we want our neighborhoods to be clean. We want our neighborhoods to be safe. Please do something. I talk about in the editorial I wrote about a mom from Head Start. We have a Head Start program, and this is located in the city's heart. And of course, people in Head Start, I mean, these are folks that are trying to come up and trying to get their kids educated and build a better life. I was at a Head Start meeting with all the mothers about vagrancy. That's what this was about, the condition of Romaine Park and about vagrancy. And so it was at this point that I thought, you know, my staff and even me calling the police department every day to break up an encampment or to confront an aggressive panhandler that was threatening someone, being the rhinoceros, stomping out the fires everywhere, is an inefficient use of time. So I thought, you know, why not begin a community discussion on how to solve the problem?
So in your use of language in this column, you try to draw a distinction here between what you call homeless individuals and what you term as vagrants. How do you define that in your view?
Okay, well,
why make that distinction?
I think it's important to make the distinction because first, let me give credit to Mayor Swearengen. Fresno Mayor Ashley Swearengen has spent years developing a strategy for dealing with homelessness, and they came up with Fresno First Steps Home. The city used to have a homeless czar position, and there are so many groups out in our community, not just the Poverello House, but the Fresno Rescue Mission, people who actually are out there connecting with homeless people, connecting with people to provide them services. And if you talk to Mayor Swearengen, she'll tell you, we've been very successful in getting folks housed. And there are people who have been housed that didn't make it. And then there are some that got housed that stayed housed. And so that's absolutely what we have to do. I'm not a bad guy. I'm not a cruel and violent person who wants to stomp humanity. I have compassion when I see people on the street as well. We have homeless folks who want to get out of that situation, who we have to connect with services and get them off the streets. But we also have these vagrants. And the way I wrote it was that homeless people have fallen on hard times and vagrants cause hard times for others. I brought an email that my office received, and I can read it. It's very brief. Hello, Clint. This went to my city email address. And this came in the my district, the inner city. These are neighborhoods that I know I've been on this program talking about. We need to bring these neighborhoods back. We need to fight for these neighborhoods. We need to fight for the people who live in these neighborhoods. Okay, so it's one of these neighborhoods where this originates from. It says, hello, Clint. I work for so-and-so funeral home, which is in your district you represent. I have a very serious problem with prostitution and a heavy increase of homeless people in our area. It's a safety concern for our clients that do business with our funeral home. Lately, we have lost some business due to the heavy and unwanted foot traffic that's occurring here on a daily basis. This is revenue and future business that we will not ever be able to secure. I have taken all measures on my end, going out there, talking to these people to move along, calling Fresno police. I've posted private property and loitering signs, submitted a letter to the chief of police so that they're aware of our problem and that they can enforce municipal code sections, and so on. And then it says, Clint, I need your help. I cannot do this by myself. Please let me know what I can do, because I do not want this problem to escalate to a more serious situation, because when I go out there and pick up the trash and the shopping carts they leave behind, I ask them to move, they verbally assault me. I have big shoulders. I'm not concerned so much for me, but for our families we serve. during the most difficult time of their lives and the safety of my coworkers. So there's your example of I receive these emails, Facebook messages, text messages, phone calls. People call my office on a daily basis. So the question is, someone on Twitter said, you have no compassion. You're a bad person. What would my Twitter friend say to this person, this business owner of a small business who's losing his livelihood because of this? I had to act. And by creating a public discussion, I'm hoping by fostering this, we can find some solutions.
Back to this issue of homeless individuals versus vagrant individuals. In your view, it sounds like what you're saying is if someone wants help, they're homeless. If somebody doesn't want help or is causing some sort of problem, they're vagrant. Is that
Sure.
With that? I guess my question then would be, if someone is a homeless individual, many times they're dealing with mental health issues. Many times they're dealing with major substance abuse issues. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that precludes them from being in a situation where they can be in a spot to get housed. You have sort of the low-hanging fruit who are the ones who the city has been successful in getting that housing. Do you think you're maybe painting with too broad a brush here, or is that potentially an issue where somebody who might be labeled as a vagrant in this context that you've set up here actually might be somebody who is not out of some malicious nature of their own volition, trying to do something evil, but they're trying to subside through panhandling or whatever they have to get along?
Yesterday, I took some journalists out to Radio Park, and that's at the corner of First and Clinton in my district, walking distance from where I live. And this is a park that we've really been fighting to revitalize and clean up. And I found a used hypodermic needle. So, sure, I have compassion for people with substance abuse problems. I hope they get the help they need. But this hypodermic needle was 20 feet from a playground. I have more compassion for that child that thinks this is a toy or something and pricks his or herself and could contract an awful and potentially deadly disease. I have compassion for my business owners who are losing their business. I mean, the question is, it's a very difficult situation, and I'm not painting anyone with any brush. The brush that I'm using is the one that says, I was elected to represent this area, and I see the quality of life deteriorating, and it has a lot to do with vagrancy. And I've heard from, like I said before, rich folks, poor folks, educated folks, uneducated folks, blue collars, white collars, Spanish speakers, English speakers, and I've received complaints from this huge swath of my community. And for me not to act, for me not to be here right now having this conversation with you and hopefully a broader conversation with our administration, our council, our police chief, I think I would be derelict in my duty.
So let's talk about your individual plan here. You have 6 points that you're talking about that you think the city should do right now to improve this situation. Let's go through them one by one. First of all, increase the police department's homeless task force from 5 to 12 officers. Budgets are always tight, Clint. If you're taking putting additional officers in this, you're taking them likely from somewhere else. We're relatively young in the fiscal year here.
Yeah.
How do you make that happen?
Well, first of all, City of Fresno's, we have budgeted and we're hiring dozens more officers this year. And in fact, if you're listening and you're interested in a career in law enforcement, we'd love to have you come down to the City of Fresno because we are recruiting right now. When it comes to the actual deployment, I don't have an opinion. I don't have an idea. I want to see right now we have a sergeant and 4 officers who are on the city's homeless task force, and they are overtaxed. They are constantly being sent out to do their job. For a city with a population of over 500,000 people, we have 5 guys that are out there dealing with this problem. And in the homeless population, the actual number is up for debate, but I mean, we're still talking about hundreds of people. Even the estimates of the people who say We have largely solved the homeless problem in our city. They say that we still have hundreds of them. So you're talking about this huge city. You're talking about this large problem involving hundreds of folks. And so we only have five officers. So you know what? We have one of the best police chiefs in the state of California right here in Fresno. And Chief Dyer is our strategist. He is our expert. And so I defer to him. I'm saying I want to see a larger homeless task force. And how that happens, I'm open to. And I'm not saying I have all the answers on this. I want to, you know, cut from this to make this happen. I want to talk to my council colleagues. I want to talk to our mayor. I want to talk to the experts in terms of getting folks housed. I want to talk to the experts in terms of finding mental health services for people. I think it's a broader conversation than just, okay, you know, Smith, Jones, and Martinez, you guys are chasing vagrants around today. I think it's broader than that.
You mentioned the city used to have a homeless czar. Do you think maybe it's time to bring that back? And should law enforcement be that first point of contact?
I don't. And again, that wasn't one of my ideas, and I don't know if we need the homeless czar to come back. I realize that the person in that position was mostly concerned with getting folks connected to services and getting folks housed. This is in addition to that. Obviously, we carry on the programs and initiatives that we have to get folks housed, to connect people with the services that we have, but we also have to address vagrancy. Parents shouldn't have to take their children to a park. And let's face it, nice neighborhood, nice part of town. Radio Park is a nice park. You got the Sam's Deli across the street. The art museum is there. And I picked up two syringes yesterday by the playground. It's unacceptable.
I want to go through some of these other things that you have here. Some of them, I think the public information campaign about encouraging residents to support homeless service organizations like First Steps Home, give to that rather than funding individuals on the street, on a street corner. That's relatively obvious. Two things, though, that stand out to me and as potentially legal issues, especially considering the city's past experience with rounding up encampments and seizure of property. You want the city to implement a park ranger program to patrol our parks and then also to do a roundup of shopping carts and take back those shopping carts from vagrants. I think most people or many people listening probably think those are generally good ideas. However, I can see that there could be some issues legally. Public parks are public spaces, and a homeless individual has a right to be there just as a person who does have a home. And then shopping carts are property from a business, but as I understand it, it's a little difficult sometimes to get those back and seize that property. The city lost a big lawsuit on that a few years ago.
Well, the police department seizes shopping carts constantly. They seize them every day. I'm asking for a sweep or two or three to go out and reclaim those carts on a larger scale.
And the city is going to retain the property of the individuals that they have in those carts.
Well, I don't know if the city has to retain them or if the person with the stolen cart can carry his or her belongings. I mean, I don't purport to know how that's done. I'm talking about the seizing stolen property and returning it to its rightful owner. That's a shopping cart. If there happens to be a blanket or a some food in the cart, that's not stolen property. Maybe. So we have to, and again, I defer to the police department because they're the ones that do this. They're the ones that have been doing this. And I am confident that they're doing it in a compassionate and judicious manner. But when you see someone pushing a cart down the street that says Vons or Target on it, that's stolen property and it needs to be returned to its owner.
You mentioned a couple of times this issue that's come up, I guess, in the last 6 months in a number of contexts, and that's the dramatic drop in the official number of homeless individuals as counted by crews that go around every year. The federal government has a procedure by which they do a point-in-time survey, and people go out, canvass neighborhoods, and count how many homeless individuals they see. In the most recent numbers, show that the city of Fresno reduced its official count by about 50% over the last 2 years.
Yes.
Yet when I talk to individuals, whether it's people who work with homeless individuals themselves, or people who are just around in neighborhoods throughout the city, they don't see that significant drop. And this comes in the context of the last 2 years. 2 years ago when the city closed down the homeless encampments in downtown. Do you believe the numbers that are in that survey? And B, do you think closing down the encampments downtown just spread those homeless throughout the city, making them harder to count because they're spread over a huge area rather than concentrated in five locations?
Well, on the encampments that were downtown that were cleaned up, I don't have a comment on that because it already happened. There's nothing we can do about it. They were closed down, and they had to be. Those were threats to health and safety, basic health and safety. The conditions in the camps downtown were deplorable, and so that had to be done. They had to be cleaned up. And then the other part of that is, do I think the count is wrong? This is not something that we're dealing with only in Fresno. This isn't something that's exclusive to our area. State of Hawaii, since I wrote my editorial, the state of Hawaii has declared a state of emergency when it comes to homelessness. The city of Los Angeles has declared a state of emergency as it relates to homelessness. So this is something that we are dealing with here in Fresno, but people are dealing with it all over the United States of America. Did the number of homeless go down? I don't see it. I don't see it because of all the complaints that I'm receiving. And so I am working to deal with it as I can, like I mentioned before, like the rhinoceros stomping out the fires in the desert. And so it seems to me that there are an awful lot of vagrants in our community. And let me say this too. We've heard so many times over and over, and I know you've had folks sitting in this chair over and over, different people say, you know, Blackstone is the new key to our city's prosperity. It needs to be cherished and cleaned up. And, you know, we hear that all these the core neighborhoods, the inner city areas are so precious to the eventual renaissance of our city in terms of fighting crime, in terms of fighting things like illegal dumping, quality of life. And so it's obviously important to keep business in these areas. And so I have more than one business owner that have come to me and said, you know, I don't know what to do. I call the police constantly, but I my family members say, let's move north. Let's go north of Herndon. And so this is another thing that I'm hearing. Hey, we don't need any more vacancy on Blackstone south of Shields. We don't need any more vacancy in these established core neighborhoods. We are trying to foster redevelopment and rebirth in these neighborhoods, and small business is the key to that. So when the small business owners call me and say, Clint, I'm buried by this. I don't know what to do. Please help me. I have a faction, you know, my partner, or I have a faction in my family that want me to move this business north. That's exactly what we don't want to happen, because of the strategy of giving new life to our older neighborhoods.
And on this issue of the homeless encampments, a statement this morning from Mayor Swearingen's spokesperson Mark Standriff, he says, and this is about the issue of whether the city really experienced a 50% drop in homelessness. And I quote here, the myth that they just move elsewhere after the mayor broke up the encampments is flat out wrong. Those people in the encampments were identified, processed, and I quote here, all found housing or help. Again, that the statement from Mayor Swearingen today. Clint, looking at this issue, obviously something that you've been passionate about, not just with this latest op-ed, but for some time now, the city adopted a 10-year plan to end chronic homelessness a while ago. A centerpiece of that is this housing-first approach, meaning we close down the encampments, whether they're sanctioned or unsanctioned encampments, get people in who are most readily available to get into housing, get them into housing, and deal with the rest as it goes. Do you think that's the right strategy? And some advocates out there say, you know what, the way to solve this is to have, like they do in Portland or in the Northwest, have a city-sanctioned encampment where people can live in a safe environment, because many people, many homeless individuals, don't want to be in a house, in a traditional housing environment. Many of them would prefer that setting. What do you say about that, and is this 10-year plan the right strategy?
I think there has to be a 10-year plan. I think that that's it's a given. It's required. I'm not calling for someone to go out with the billy club and club vagrants and homeless people over the head and buy them bus tickets to Reno. That's not part of my six-point plan.
I didn't see that.
No. My six-point plan, and you're bringing up kind of the last one, to convene a committee similar to the one we did with the Blighted Homes last year or at the beginning of this year, where we brought the mayor's office and the city council and the police department, and we brought activists, people who were fighting on behalf of tenants. We brought the some land, you know, apartment owners. We had a big task force of community stakeholders, and we worked. We came out with a piece of legislation. We came out with an ordinance that the city council adopted, I think by a 7-0 margin, unanimously. And we, as a community, tackled that problem of blighted homes. Now, there's still work to be done on blighted homes, but as far as this, the problem of homelessness and vagrancy, we have to replicate that. So, you know, you're talking about housing first and providing services. Absolutely. We have to continue that. And I'm in full support of that. But the other part of this that needs to be addressed is the losses that our businesses are taking because due to this, the cost of repairing, the cost of replacing broken and vandalized things. This is going on at the at our parks too. And the parks, some of the park bathrooms are in deplorable condition. And those need to be cleaned and repaired and kept safe for our children who need a safe place to play. We just came out of this huge Parks for All thing. That was a huge dust up over the bus ad, and the California Endowment is saying we don't have enough parks, and the whole back and forth with the Parks Master Plan here in the city of Fresno. Well, the parks we have are not being properly cared for on a scale that I would like to see. And so we can vet all these issues. We can have this discussion as a community when we convene this committee, because everything's a part of it. Somebody tagged me on Facebook today. A nonprofit has a bus that has showers in it, and it can be rolled out so people who are homeless or vagrant or whatever can take advantage of getting clean in this bus that is now a big shower on wheels. Absolutely. That's a great idea. That should be an idea that's welcome at the table too.
Do you think that we're close to getting to a turning point? The administration says we're at a turning point. We're already going in the right direction. Sounds like you're saying things are not getting better right now, though we have some good things in the works. But on the ground, it's still bad. I mean, the administration's talking about they have this new thing with the POV, MapPoint. They say don't call the police, call MapPoint at the POV, and that'll get these services to these people. It sounds like, and I've talked to the mayor about this, we had a big panel discussion last week, she's saying we have turned the corner. Do you think we're – maybe the corner's in sight? Where do you stand on that before we go?
I think that we've done a lot, but this isn't about what we've done. This is about what still needs to be done. I can't with a straight face look my constituents in the eye and say, oh, well, here's what I've done, because we have a mountain to climb. That's great. I'm very proud of the city of Fresno. I'm proud to have a mayor like Ashley Swearingen, who's spent countless hours and worked so hard to get folks housed. I'm very proud of that. But this isn't about what we've done. This is about what we still have yet to accomplish. And what we have yet to accomplish is to provide a safe and clean environment for our community and our citizens and our neighborhoods.
Fresno City Councilmember Clint Olivier. His six-point plan to address vagrancy and homelessness is in an op-ed at the Fresno Bee. Clint is also running for the 31st Assembly District seat. Clint, thank you so much for joining us today and taking the time to talk about this important issue.
Thank you very much for having me.
Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment on Valley Edition and find out how UC researchers are examining a plant that's dealing with the drought in a rather remarkable way by changing its DNA. That's coming up next on Valley Edition. This is Valley Edition. A group of researchers in the Central Valley has just been awarded a grant to study how plant genetics are changing in response to drought conditions. Sounds like an amazing thing. The focus of their research is on sorghum, which is proving to be one of the most drought-adaptive plants in the world. Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess spoke with researcher Jeff Dahlberg about how unlocking the secrets of sorghum could have big implications for other crops and the valley.
And this week you all announced that you got a rather significant grant for some research into sorghum. Tell me why. What's it for?
There's a tremendous amount of interest in crops that are drought tolerant in the United States right now. And the Department of Energy is looking at how to enhance some of the biomass feedstocks that they're looking into. So that they can grow on more marginal lands. And obviously one of the issues that they would face would be drought. And sorghum is one of the most drought-tolerant cereal crops that we grow in the world. And there's just been a lot of interest in looking at sorghum and trying to figure out what that drought's tolerance is.
That's what I was going to ask. Do we know why sorghum is so drought-tolerant, or is that what this research is for?
Well, we have a lot of theories behind why it's drought tolerant. There's a lot of mechanisms that sorghum seems to possess that allows it to utilize water more efficiently when there's not a lot of water around. And so we're trying to tease out some of that genetically. We're trying to understand how these different mechanisms are turned on and off, why they're turned on and off, when they're turned on and off. And interestingly enough, we also believe that there's some soil microbial populations that might influence sorghum's ability to withstand drought, too. So we're looking at how those communities are impacted by drought and, you know, what kind of relationship there is between sorghum and those communities and how they might benefit each other.
You had 2 points there, and I kind of want to take them one at a time.
Sure.
The first one being, when you talk about mechanisms in the plant, you're talking about the plant's genetics? Like there are certain genetic factors that tick on and tick off depending on the conditions?
Yeah. Things like perhaps what shuts the stomates close. You know, remember the stomates are kind of the breathing apparatus for a plant, so they, you know, let some water in, but they let out oxygen, they let CO2 in. You know, it's all part of this fairly complex mechanism that plants use to generate biomass and create biomass. So, you know, what controls that? Because if you open and close those at certain times of the day, not as much water leaves the plant. There are things like waxes. Some sorghums have lots of wax on their leaves and stems, and that might slow down water evaporating from the plant. Sorghum does some other things with sugars inside the plant to help retain water in the plant. There's just all these different mechanisms that sorghum utilizes to try and stay alive during a drought, and that's what we're trying to look at. What are the genes that are responsible for those? When are they turned on? When are they turned off? So it's a rather ambitious research project.
And you mentioned the microbes in the soil. Is there some thinking that those microbes are reacting to the drought and that's what's telling the plant to change its survival strategies?
That's what some of the questions are. I mean, you know, you think about it, a lot of the research that we do in agriculture, you know, it's everything above ground. But there's a lot of stuff going on below ground that we just don't really understand. So there's some real new thinking coming out about these communities in the soil and how they may interact with the plants to help them respond better to certain stresses, i.e. drought, or if there's an insect stress or a pathogen stress. And these are the kind of questions we're putting out there and trying to see if we can discern them.
What is sorghum used for? Why? I understand the plant has unique capabilities, but is it used for anything? What's the point behind focusing on sorghum?
Yeah, sorghum is actually the fifth most important cereal crop in the world, so it's used extensively in Africa and India for food production. Here in the United States, it's used primarily as an animal feed. So you'll see grain sorghum and forage sorghums going into animal feed production. But sorghum is also a very unique annual crop in that it can produce a tremendous amount of biomass rather quickly in about 100 days. And so the Department of Energy, which is interested in renewable fuels and biomass feedstocks that can produce lots of biomass, they're very interested in looking at all these kind of crops that can do that, and sorghum is one of the leading crops right now for them to be looking at. So that's part of the reason why we're doing this here.
Biomass potentially for what, for fuels and stuff?
Yeah, for fuels. But I think more importantly down the road for really extracting the sugars that are in plants and then using those sugars to create, other biodegradable plastics, renewable materials, and fuel.
And so is there anything that can be taken from this when you finish? I guess it's not going to be any time in like the next couple of weeks, but when you finish, is there anything that could be applied, you think, to other plants, other agricultural crops in the valley?
Yeah, I think there's many of us in the scientific community that believe that a lot of these genes for drought tolerance are fairly common in a lot of plants, I think, especially in the cereal crop. So whatever we can learn out of sorghum, which we're viewing as a model crop for other crop species, whatever we can learn. So, for example, say we discover five or six sets of genes that relate back to something that seems to be really important in drought tolerance. We can actually sequence those genes and then put those sequences out for the general scientific community to use, and they can use those sequences to maybe explore the genomes that they're interested in, so maybe the wheat folks or the rice or the maize people, the corn people, could take those gene sequences and look for those sequences to see if they're actually in their species of interest. And so if they are, then there's a potential for actually being able to turn those genes on and off in other crop species and perhaps make them more drought tolerant. So that's that's what we'd really like to be able to find out and make available to the rest of the scientific community. And we think this could have tremendous impact on our ability to, feed the world in the future. If we can get these plants if these plants actually do contain similar genes, and then trying to figure out how to turn them on so that they can utilize water more efficiently would be great.
That's Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess speaking with researcher Jeff Dahlberg about new research going on in the Valley about how sorghum is changing its DNA to adapt to the drought and how it might change other plants and the Valley's agriculture industry for the future. This is Valley Edition. It's the dream of every yard sale and antique store patron, finding a rare gem for a couple of bucks that could turn out to be worth millions. It's what happened to one local individual who bought a couple of photos at a Tower District antique shop for a couple dollars. They turned out to have an amazing story, or at least one of them did, turning out to be potentially one of only two photos that exist of the famed Billy the Kid. Our next guest is the man who produced the documentary that aired this past weekend on National Geographic about that issue. His name is Jeff Aiello. He joins us today on Valley Edition. Jeff, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Can you guys hear me all right?
Yes, hear you just fine. Jeff, great. You worked for many years at Channel 30 here, left that job, and started doing your own films. How did you come across this story about this photo that was bought at the old, Fulton's Folly Antique Shop?
Yeah, it happened about a year ago. Another local television personality that happens to be friends of mine, George Cicada, on Channel 24, he and I were having lunch one day in Clovis, and we were talking about some new television show ideas, reality television show ideas, different types of things. He said, hey, come on down to Clovis. I want you to meet the guys at Clovis Collectibles, Sports Cards, and Coins on Glassier. So I went in, and we talked to the guys. I met Brad Stoops, Joe Conway, and Randy Gajaro there. And we spoke a little bit about, you know, some ideas they had about doing a collectible show. And then when we finished that discussion, they walked into the back room, and there they had this blown-up photograph that the world knows pretty well now, the Croquet photograph. And they, you know, I started asking questions about it. We talked about it. And the short version is, I determined pretty quickly that he had a fascinating story in that he had this photograph. He was an adept enough collector to realize that it looked like the authenticated and icon photo of Billy the Kid, the one and only at the time, and that, you know, when he told me he tried to get this thing authenticated, that several of the experts or leaders in that world kind of dismissed the photograph, wouldn't even look at it really. And that set up a red flag, and so that's when I got interested and said, let me take the photograph for a month or two, do my research on it, and then if I feel comfortable that it's authentic, then I think we should document your journey to continue to prove that this thing is real to the world, and do it in a way that kind of goes around these guys, these men that kind of hold court over what is considered authentic or not in the world of Western Americana.
How difficult was it convincing National Geographic and the others involved? You had to go through a lot of steps to get this authenticated. And this is, again, a photo of a group of gentlemen, one of them presumably Billy the Kid, playing croquet in front of an old sort of Old West style building with some oak trees in the background, found in this Fresno antique shop. Presumably the photo was taken in New Mexico. Was it difficult to try to convince a organization like National Geographic that, yeah, we've really done our homework and we really think this is the real deal?
It actually was the opposite. It happened so fast and so at such a speed that in this world, in the television world, it was the exception to the rule. Normally, the process to get a television show on television, from point of inception of idea to actually it airing, it can take 2 years easily. And with this one, we did our research. We had a pretty good package put together based on some really good work that my wife Jo and I had done. And when I teamed up with Left Field Pictures, which is the company that produces the show Pawn Stars, the guys over there are friends of mine. They heard I was working on this. They looked at some of my stuff, and they go, hey, man, this is huge. We got to take this to the networks. And they asked if they could do a co-production deal with me. So I did that with them literally on a Monday. I signed the contract on a Monday.
Wow.
And then they took it to Nat Geo. And when I say they, the head of their company took it to they went to Discovery Channel, National Geographic, and History Channel, all at the same time. And Discovery passed on it immediately. It was too historic, was their response. And History Channel wanted it badly, and Nat Geo wanted it badly. And there was a knife fight over it, basically. They went back and forth, and Nat Geo ended up making the better offer at the end of the day. It was a good problem to have. That happened on Wednesday, 2 days after I signed the co-pro deal. So within a week, we went from co-pro deal to signed production deal with National Geographic, which is unheard of.
When did you convince yourself that it was real? You mentioned that you spent some time to authenticate it. You had to go into it skeptical initially. When did you finally say, hey, you know what, I think this guy really does have something here?
What's fascinating about this photograph is that, and now that after we've had the airing of the documentary on Sunday night, you have to understand, this documentary and Billy the Kid trended number one on Facebook and Twitter for 4 days in a row last week. Ahead of the Star Wars, new Star Wars trailer. So there's a huge interest in Billy the Kid. When I looked at it, I fell into the camp, and there are two camps on this topic, where it was clearly obvious to me he looked and strongly resembled the known and authenticated photograph of Billy, what's called the Upham photo, the icon photo of Billy. And so when I looked at it, there were clear markers, and I spend a lot of time as a photographer, I look at photographs a lot. So I might have a little bit better trained eye than the average bear, but it just jumped out at me. And then when I looked at two other people in the photograph, and they looked very similar to their known and authenticated photographs, that's when I went, well, look, it's easy to dismiss one lookalike in a photograph, but when you have in our photograph five lookalikes, that tells you something. And that's when we really dove in to understand the story of Billy the Kid, the Lincoln County War, and the history of their movements, the well-recorded, documented history of their movements. And by doing that, we developed a timeline of when all of those individuals could have and would have been together at one place and one time, and it became clear that that was only within a two-week period at the end of August and the first week of September of 1878. So then we drilled into that date and found, documentation that supported that those people moved together and were together, and that's when the pieces started to fall into place.
Jeff, before we go, how do you follow this up? What's your second act? Certainly was a big splash out of the gate.
No, yeah. I mean, we've done a spinoff television show with one of the characters. If you saw the documentary on Sunday night, the investigator in New Mexico, Steve Cedarwall. We have a new show in development with him right now that's being shot at History Channel this week called Cold West Investigations. And I've got a documentary I'm planning to do on Chief Tenaya and his fall from power in Yosemite Valley in 1851 by the Mariposa Battalion. So we're looking at doing that next week.
Very interesting. We'll follow that again. Local television producer Jeff Aiello, the man behind the documentary that aired this past weekend on Nat Geo about the long-lost photo of Billy the Kid discovered in a Fresno antique store for $2. Some say it could be worth as much as $5 million. Jeff, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
That's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, you can let us know what you think. The email is talk@kvpr.org, and we always welcome you to send us a tweet @KVPR and @Valley Edition. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporters Jeffrey Hess and Diana Aguilera, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.